ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to God Forbid on ABC Radio National and across the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. I'm James Carlton with the next in our special series on religious rebels. We've looked at Joan of Arc and John Calvin, Giordano Bruno and Malcolm X, religious rebels who've defied empire and tradition and sometimes even paid with their life. And today, the pioneering feminist of the 20th century, Dorothy Day. She defied presidents and police chiefs, as well as bishops and cardinals. And she paid for it at times with her freedom, her reputation, certainly her comfort. Yet today, they want to make her a saint. You see, Dorothy Day from the United States was an anarchist, as well as a devout Catholic, the founder of the global Catholic worker movement. So let's hear from Dorothy Day herself. The year is 1971. She's 74 years old on the TV show Christopher Close-Up, explaining why she started the Catholic worker movement with its mission of radical pacifism and feeding the poor.
If your brother is hungry, you feed him. You don't meet him at the door and say, go be thou filled, or wait for a few weeks and you'll get a welfare check. You sit him down and feed him. And so that's how the soup kitchen started. As a matter of fact, we didn't start it at all. We were feeding a house full of people, but one of the men who had charge of the clothes room didn't have any more clothes to give out, so he began saying, just come in and have a cup of coffee. And so pretty soon a line formed at the door. It became a soup line, and we still have the soup line, a couple of hundred people a day coming in. It's far easier to see Christ in your brother when you're sitting down and sharing soup with him.
Founder of the Catholic worker movement, anarchist and pacifist Dorothy Day, speaking in 1971. She died in 1980 at the age of 83. We'll analyse those words shortly. She's the religious rebel we're profiling, the last in our series on religious rebels. And a religious rebel she was, because though she was devoutly Catholic, her pacifism during World War II caused friction. You see, the bishops supported the Allied war effort. But Dorothy Day and the Catholic Worker newspaper she edited argued warfare violated Christian nonviolence, and she drew on papal encyclicals to make those very points. Today's pontiff, Pope Leo, hails from Chicago's South Side, the same impoverished neighbourhood that Dorothy Day once called home. But the tension is gone. Pope Leo only last month called Dorothy Day a pilgrim of hope and a servant of God in his special 2025 Jubilee Year audience at St. Peter's Square in Rome. The Pope spoke in Italian of her life and times.
I would like to recall a small yet great American woman, Dorothy Day, who lived in the last century. She had fire within her. Dorothy Day took a stand. She saw that the development model of her country did not create the same opportunities for everyone. She realized that for too many people to dream, the dream was a nightmare, and that as a Christian, she had to become involved with workers, with migrants, with those cast aside by an economy that kills. She wrote as a journalist. That is, she thought and helped others to think. She united mind, heart, and hands. In this way, to hope is to take a stand.
Through a translator, Pope Leo XIV, talking about his fellow American, Dorothy Day. And though she died in 1980, her legacy lives. The Catholic Worker newspaper is still in print and still just a penny. But around the world, there are also her houses of hospitality, small, autonomous, even anarchic homes and farmhouses and shelters where all are welcome for food and clothing and companionship and shelter. They're part of the Catholic Worker Movement, the first set up by Dorothy Day in New York during the Great Depression, and hundreds are still operational in Europe, North America, and Australia and New Zealand. Later we'll meet her granddaughter, who grew up with her, her comrade who worked alongside her. But first, Paul Eli from the Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace and World Affairs. His book, The Life You Save, may be your own biography of Dorothy Day. Paul, tell me more about what attracts you to the life of this remarkable woman.
I'm not sure in a simple way. Pascal in the Pensées said very mysteriously, make religion attractive. And it's a strange or mysterious statement because it's only three words. And what does he mean? Of course, we want religion to be attractive in the sense that evangelism is a sense of attracting people. But there are certain people who make religion attractive in the sense that you really want to kind of be like them or imitate them. My own sense, and the sense that then powered the pretty long book that I wrote about Dorothy Day and other American Catholics, is that they made religion attractive. I know I found her mixture of bohemian dash, voluntary poverty, pacifism, anarchism, journalism, New York street smart, everyday life, and common sense, and biblical eloquence very attractive, and I still do.
And quite the achievement of Dorothy Day to make religion attractive. After all, we live in an era of secular individualism. But she didn't do it by proselytizing. Rather, it was her example, her bohemian dash mixed with anarchic street smarts, all of which were visible even before she became a Catholic. She was in her 20s during the Roaring Twenties, just before the Great Depression, and she had a reputation of hard drinking and free loving. But Dorothy Day's granddaughter, Martha Hennessy, doesn't like that description. She's now 70, a lifelong peace activist herself, and she told Radio National, God forbid, that that description doesn't match the saintly grandmother she remembers.
I don't like it when people introduce her as hard-drinking, free-loving, because I don't know if that's actually true about her, the free-loving part, but she certainly is a saint for our times. I remember her being a very quiet, very powerful, very loving presence. And I think others can give you a better encapsulation of the chronology of the history of her life. It wouldn't be anything that I would know because, you know, I wasn't born until 1955.
And we'll hear more later from Martha Hennessy, Dorothy Day's granddaughter. But someone who also knew and loved her is Robert Ellsberg. Now, you may know Robert's father, Daniel Ellsberg, famous for leaking the Pentagon Papers in 1971, thereby exposing the lies of successive U.S. presidents about the Vietnam War. The father, Daniel Ellsberg, was charged under the Espionage Act and faced 115 years in jail, but was acquitted only after proving the evidence against him was illegally gathered by the same people who would go on to perpetrate the Watergate scandal. At the time, the young Robert Ellsberg, just a 13-year-old boy, helped his father photocopy the top-secret Pentagon Papers. Later, he went to Harvard, dropped out, intended to stay for a short while at the Catholic Worker House in New York, but ended up staying, eventually becoming managing editor of the Catholic Worker newspaper. Robert Ellsberg here is speaking with ABC Radio National, God forbid, about the formative years of Dorothy Day, his friend and mentor.
Dorothy grew up in New York, in San Francisco, and Chicago. Her father was a sports writer. She dropped out of college after her second year to move to New York City. She had become greatly interested in the radical labor movement while she was in Chicago, and she hoped that she could write for progressive left-wing journals in New York City. And she did get a job working for a socialist newspaper and then other radical journals as well. And she was in, you know, in the middle of a kind of bohemian circles, certainly in New York City at that time. And it was a time of the Russian Revolution, and there were protests against World War I. And she knew people who were going to jail as anti-war activists. But a turning point in her life came when she was living with a man in Staten Island whom she loved. That's Martha's grandfather, as a matter of fact. His name is Forster Batterham. They weren't married, but they were very much in love. And in the course of that relationship, she found that she was pregnant. And she made a kind of an astonishing decision that she wanted to have her baby baptized as a Catholic. She had been kind of searching for some sort of deeper meaning in her life and had gone through some hard times. But it was in the context of her great happiness in this love and in the prospect of having a child that she just felt this incredible gratitude toward God was the only thing big enough to accept it. So she decided to have the baby baptized, and she herself followed by becoming a Catholic, though this meant the separation from her, what she called common-law husband, Forster, because he would not get married. He was an anarchist and did not believe in marriage either by the state or the church. And in becoming a Catholic, she felt she couldn't live with him anymore. So she made this great sacrifice. And she became a single mother, kind of supporting her daughter as she could, but all this time kind of searching for some deeper meaning. What was this all for? She really felt that she had not only left the father of her child, but she had a kind of betrayed the working class, she felt, in becoming a Catholic. Even though she felt the Catholic Church was the church of the poor, she felt that it was allied too often with the rich and powerful. So she spent some kind of years sort of drifting and ultimately made this prayer that she would find some way to combine her commitment to the poor and oppressed with her religious faith. And at that point, and this was in December 1932, she met a French man named Peter Morin, who was kind of a autodidact philosopher and tramp who had been traveling around the country. He'd emigrated from France, and he had been doing great study of philosophy, economics, sociology, politics, and Catholic history. And someone suggested that he look for Dorothy Day, and he immediately began describing this plan he had for a new Catholic movement that would publicize the radical social message of the gospel. And this was exactly what Dorothy had been looking for. And so she ran with that, first by starting a newspaper called The Catholic Worker, and then soon after that, opening a house of hospitality for the Works of Mercy. This is in the height of the Depression, feeding the hungry, clothing the naked, offering shelter to the homeless. And soon this developed into a movement of similar communities around the country. And what was extraordinary about the Worker as a lay movement, not priests in charge, she didn't ask permission or authorization from authorities in the church, but as lay people exercising their freedom and their responsibility to follow Christ in response to the needs of the time. And so she was combining the works of mercy, the kind of traditional charity that many other religious communities have practiced over the years, with a passion for justice, because she didn't believe it was enough just to feed people. You had to also challenge the social structures and institutions that cause so much injustice and inequality.
Robert Ellsberg, who worked for 5 years with Dorothy Day, the experience forever changing his life. And he wasn't the only one. Paul Eli, Dorothy Day's biographer, said this was the thing about Dorothy Day's evangelism. You'll remember he told us of the infectious mixture of her bohemian dash, her voluntary poverty, her anarchism, pacifism, journalism, all mixed up with biblical eloquence and New York street smarts. Well, that would change the lives of many she encountered.
Absolutely. And like most people, I encountered Dorothy Day through her writing. It's striking when you look back at the encounters that people had with her writing. They would then beat a path down to the Catholic Worker in the East Village. It currently has a couple of houses, one on East 1st and one on East 3rd. And they'd expect her to open the door. She so embodied the movement that and so personalized it that they couldn't imagine that she wasn't just there all the time. And she was traveling, she was giving talks, she was raising money, she was Catholic Worker Farms, etc. Something else, though, a friend of mine and a longtime editor of mine at Commonweal magazine, Patrick Jordan, died a couple of months ago. And Patrick, who was a brilliant man, a Catholic from California, came to New York City after university, deciding that he was going to work at the Catholic Worker. He showed up. His first task was to repaint Dorothy Day's room, as I recall. Anyway, he did that. She made him managing editor of the Catholic Worker. And then she said, in effect, you should do our kind of journalism out in the world. He became an editor with Commonweal magazine and did it for 35, 40 years. She had the power of saying to this brilliant, determined young man, like, this is what you should do with your life. I'm telling you to do it. Now go do it. And he did it. And he died, as I say, a couple of months ago. And his funeral was at the Catholic Worker. This is not a pliable person, but she had that presence, able to say, go and do what I'm urging you to do. And he went and did it. And it was his life. And that's not the only person. I know at least three brilliant men, all of whom dedicated their lives essentially to carrying out kind of soft command that Dorothy Day had given them at a certain point in their lives. Amazing.
And this is the 20th century when the cult of individualism was well upon us.
Exactly. And where these guys are not the type of people who are just going to, they're not looking for someone to tell them what to do. But they recognized she had authority in the sense that Kierkegaard used the term, which is that this person knows something and is able to tell you what to do based on that knowledge. It's not an intellectual knowledge. It's a knowledge about existence. And that's why they call Kierkegaard an existentialist. He grasped something about existence, and so did Dorothy Day.
And it really is timeless. And yet, let's get to her time. The early days, the Depression, New York, before she even became a Catholic. Tell me about her anarchist times when you wrote she drank all night and would wander into strange churches at dawn. She would rally for the masses, go to jail, write a novel, fall in love, marry on the rebound, all in her 20s.
Amazing. Just the sheer vitality, and you've captured that in the quote that you just read. So Dorothy Day was born in 1897. She founded the Catholic Worker in 1933, so she was 35 or 36 years old. In that time, she got educated, learned to write, traveled, wrote a screenplay, decided to commit herself to working as a journalist to improve the lives of the less fortunate, as we now call them, the poor. With the series, you know, Religious Rebels in mind, in some way she was a rebel among the activists of, first of all, of Bohemia, and then of anarchism and Marxism in New York City. And she was a rebel because on some deep level, she was a person of faith. They didn't believe in some sort of higher power or force. For her, it was instinctive, her gratitude to creation, to the creator, her gratitude for her own life was the basis for everything she did. And that made her feel that she didn't really fit in the Bohemian community, which was about going one's own way and pursuing one's vision and, you know, kind of self-gratification. And didn't fit in well among the anarchists and Marxists, for whom had to do with merging with the class struggle. She felt this primordial gratitude, and so she didn't fit into that world. She pondered it for a bit, realized that both the Bohemians and the anarchists and Marxists were committed to improving the lives of the poor. But at that time, teens and 20s, especially in New York City, so many of the poor were Catholics. So she kind of got with the Catholics and realized that by becoming a Catholic, she could be joined to the poor and move with the poor and speak with the poor and live with the poor in a way that was much more authentic in her view than if she just kind of worked for their cause as an activist or agitator. And in a way, that was her rebellion, to work for the poor by joining the poor, by joining the Catholic Church.
Yes. But by rebelling, she was at the same time, paradoxically, this woman of paradox, becoming orthodox. Because, as you explain beautifully, when you ministered, when you serve, when you work for the poor, especially in New York, you're working for Irish and Italians and Poles. They're not communists, they're Catholics. You know, you may be excluded from the Bohemian salons, but you'll be included in the tenements. Yes?
That's what she felt. And you can't draw the lines very, very firmly. And there were plenty of the Jewish poor, especially in New York at that time. But just to take a vivid example from her memoirs, she would go out to the taverns in the village. The best known one is called the Golden Swan. Eugene O'Neill was there, and he liked to drink, and he liked to recite poetry aloud. It was probably as lively a night as ever passed in the village, right? But they closed the place at 4 or 5 in the morning, and she wound up at church at 6 a.m. There was a mass for longshoremen who had to go to work at 7 a.m., and that was a kind of homecoming for her. She would leave the bohemian scene, where O'Neill, a lapsed Catholic of a kind, would read crypto-religious poetry, The Hound of Heaven by Francis Thompson, and wind up going to Mass and saying to herself, what am I doing here? On some level, this is where I belong. I mean, she was impelled there by everything that had happened in the previous 8 hours or whatever, but the community that she felt in the early Mass was somehow deeper, more perduring than the community that she felt at the Golden Swan.
So tell me about the Catholic Worker, her and the Catholic Worker movement.
So in 1932, that was a low point in the Depression in the United States. She evoked it in her memoirs. You know, no smoke came from the factories. The trucks were stilled on the streets. The workers, I think it was farmers, had staged a giant protest in Washington by taking their trucks and carts to the Capitol because they had no work. So they formed a kind of caravan in Washington, D.C. She covered as a journalist, writing it, you know, for some radical newspaper. And she had already become a Catholic. She felt a lack of fit between her radical instincts and her Catholic belief, which was still relatively new. She went to the Basilica of the Immaculate Conception in Washington that day, not far from where the rally concluded, and just prayed, like, help me find my way. Help me figure out how to put these things together. She got back to New York, and she stayed with her sister on the East Side. And weirdly, there was a knock on the door, and it was this bedraggled, not young, heavily French-accented man, Peter Morin. And he said, the editors of Commonweal said that you and I have to meet. We should do something together. And this was an instance in which the cliche is actually literally true, that it was an answered prayer. They decided to make this newspaper, The Catholic Worker. May 1st, 33, they printed some newspapers. They distributed them in Union Square in Lower Manhattan. And they were off and running. It was only then that there was some labor strife and some unemployed workers said, like, we don't have anywhere to stay. Can we stay with you? We don't have anything to eat. Can we put together some meals here? So what began as a newspaper wound up being a house of hospitality and a base for alternative living, and the rest is history.
Dorothy Day's biographer, Paul Eli, and Dorothy Day's comrade and one-time editor of The Catholic Worker, Robert Ellsberg, confirms the newspaper came first. The Catholic Worker movement was then built around it. And all after that bedraggled, self-educated French peasant philosopher Peter Morin knocked on Dorothy's door with the idea of a Catholic Worker newspaper, the answer to her prayers.
He actually wanted to call it the Catholic Radical, and Dorothy chose the Catholic Worker because it sounded more like the Communist Daily Worker. So she had that connection sort of in mind. And it was then, you know, in the Catholic Worker, Peter Morin's philosophy was all about the works of mercy and community and personal responsibility. And people began knocking on the door and saying, well, where are these houses of hospitality that you're writing about? And so they have rented a storefront and began a soup kitchen that became larger houses where they could provide shelter to you know, a certain number of people. But Dorothy and Peter's idea always was that these were kind of symbolic gestures that showed what the world could look like if we lived, you know, according to the gospel and according to alternative values of cooperation and solidarity and compassion rather than, you know, competition and greed. So the paper really took off very quickly. She first distributed the copies of the paper at a communist rally in Union Square on May Day in 1933. That was the birth of the Catholic Worker. People were first, I think, kind of curious about what this was all about. But there were actually a lot of people in the church who, you know, this is the Depression here, and felt this great hunger for Catholics, for the church to be addressing these great social issues. So it began to spread very quickly. Within a couple of years, they had 100,000, 200,000 subscriptions. There were seminaries and churches that were buying big bundle copies of it. And that, you know, became the seed for new Catholic Worker communities all over the country. Dorothy would travel around and offer support to them, but they were all independent, but just kind of signing in onto this basic idea. It was with World War II when Dorothy maintained her pacifist position. After Pearl Harbor, she printed an editorial where she said, you know, should we speak or should we keep silent? If we speak, what should we say? And she said, basically, we're going to say what we've always said, that our manifesto is the Sermon on the Mount. Now, that was going too far for a lot of people, and the circulation of the paper plummeted, and a lot of the houses emptied out too as unemployment decreased and a lot of people went to serve in the military. So it was a kind of a time in the wilderness there for the Catholic Worker. It was in the 1950s that the Catholic Worker and Dorothy moved more directly into the direction of nonviolent action during the Cold War, when they began engaging in civil disobedience by not cooperating with compulsory civil defense drills. And every year she would be arrested and go to jail for a little while. And of course, a lot of people thought that she was a communist or a traitor or a heretic or whatever. But there were people like Thomas Merton who were impressed and reached out to her and wanted to start contributing to the Worker because it really stood for something unique in the church.
Friend and mentee of Dorothy Day and former editor of the Catholic Worker newspaper, Robert Ellsberg. And it's understandable that a pro-worker newspaper would survive in the Depression. Less so that a pacifist paper would survive through World War II, and less likely still that Catholic Worker houses, shelters, farmhouses, communities would survive, indeed thrive, in the 20th century and today. Dorothy Day's biographer Paul Eli says it's extraordinary.
Extraordinary and truly strange in that there's no handbook for how to make a Catholic Worker house. There's an annual or semi-annual statement of aims and precepts that's put out by the main newspaper in New York and by other newspapers. It's not a franchise. There's not a set of codes that you have to subscribe to if you're going to become a Catholic Worker house. It's very mysterious. Some are more anarchist houses. Some are more Catholic houses. Some are more devoted to the poor. Some are more devoted to anti-war protest or pacifism. But they all somehow have got this charisma of Dorothy Day. And you mentioned the newspaper that sold for a penny a copy and still does. So here in the United States, the U.S. Treasury has just decided to cease manufacturing pennies. So the Catholic Worker, which sells for a penny a copy, has outlasted the penny. Amazing.
You'll have to wait for 5 editions to use a nickel.
To pay a nickel, yeah. 25 cents a year, I think, which Flannery O'Connor, the Catholic novelist, said is the ideal subscription price.
You've called Dorothy Day the patron saint of paradox. Why?
A whole bunch of reasons. The obvious one is that she wanted to be a saint, but didn't want to be dismissed as merely a saint. She believed in the saints. She wrote a book about Saint Therese. She referred constantly to the saints as companions on the way. They were real living figures for her. The Catholic Worker featured linoleum block prints and woodcuts of images of the saints probably in just about every issue since 1933. So this is a person whose relationship to the economy of sanctity is real and quite traditional, orthodox, and ongoing. And yet, she said of herself, "Don't make me a saint. I don't want to be dismissed that easily." I think she would have welcomed the conversation we're having. She would have welcomed the fact that people are trying to imitate her life, because that's the way sainthood works. What she didn't like in the economy of sainthood is the way saints can be declawed or made to be simple paragons of virtue. She was a virtuous woman, but she struggled with her own character. Somebody once mentioned anger in her presence, and she said, young man, I've restrained more anger in 1 minute than you've restrained in your entire life. She would fast for peace, especially during the Second Vatican Council, but it wasn't simple. She would listen to the opera on the radio beforehand or go to the live opera to sate her senses before the fast. She was a person of deep faith, but she felt kinship with people she knew, many from the Bohemian movement who had committed suicide. She would pray for them regularly, and she had all their names written in her personal Bible, over 40 people. So this patron saint of paradox, virtuous but well acquainted with anger, was a force of life but was well acquainted with despair and the forces of death, could fast but had carnal knowledge and a love of the life of the senses. And that's what I mean when I call her the patron saint of paradox.
But remember, this is a woman who's grateful and angry at once throughout her life. Are they forces which temper each other in a positive, virtuous way? You know, to be angry helps you change the world, yet to be grateful allows you to live in it.
I think that's right. And I think it's another paradox of this patron saint of paradox. And it's one that the new Pope, Pope Leo, who's an American, born and bred in Chicago, where Dorothy Day spent much of her young life, you know, he understands her, and he spoke about it the other day in Rome. He said, and the paradox that we're discussing here comes through in his remarks, moved by the fire of love, essentially what I'm calling gratitude, she denounced the indifference of false peace and the injustices of her time. So the love or gratitude led her to feel angry about the breach of it or the violation of it, the false peace and injustices for time. That's what Pope Leo is getting at when he references Dorothy Day, that precisely because she felt so grateful for creation, the violation of the rights of man, as they were called, and of the community of brothers and sisters infuriated her.
Paul Eli, with me, James Carlton, on ABC Radio National. This is, God forbid, the sixth and final episode of our special series on religious rebels. This week, Dorothy Day. She started the Catholic Worker newspaper and the Catholic Worker movement. Both survived to this day. She died in 1980 at the age of 83. Well, Dorothy Day may have been a fearsome woman in the face of injustice, but in the presence of her granddaughter, she was as tender as any child could want. Martha Hennessy is now 70, and the apple didn't fall far from the tree. She is a lifelong peace activist who's also been jailed for her non-violent resistance. She shared with God Forbid on ABC Radio National her memories of Dorothy Day.
I guess I would describe her in my life as a very ordinary grandmother. I mean, my father left the family when I was six, so it was very much my mother and my grandmother who were the adults in my life. And my grandfather, I really didn't know him. I didn't see much of him at all in my childhood. And so I would say that Dorothy's presence was very strong, very gentle, very straightforward, comforting. And I think that both Tom and Dorothy very much instilled in me a very important sense of being aware of the suffering of others. I think that the two of them very closely understood the gospel teachings in terms of practical, everyday living and thinking and attitudes and how we treat one another. I think my very first memory of her was perhaps when I was around three, sitting on her lap and feeling the presence of God. You know, my ear on her chest, very close to her heart, hearing her voice resonate. That's just a moment that stayed with me at a very young age. And so we could see her power. We understood that she was an ordinary grandmother to us, but certainly extraordinary in the world, and that she belonged to more than just her own family. She belonged to the world, the larger family. And both of my mother and grandmother gave me a very clear sense of understanding the definition of family beyond the biological. So I very much appreciate what the two of them gave me in terms of how we walk in this world.
And it was with these two families in mind, Dorothy Day's biological family and her broader human family, that she engaged in nonviolent resistance to war. In 1955, at the height of McCarthyism and the Red Scare, Americans were also afraid of nuclear annihilation. But Dorothy and her followers refused to duck and cover. She was one of 27 arrested in New York for refusing to participate in civil defense drills. She and her protesters sat on park benches and prayed instead. Her message was hiding under a school desk would not save the world from Armageddon. Nuclear disarmament was the only solution. 63 years later, Dorothy's granddaughter, Martha, continued her fight. She was one of the Kings Bay Plowshare Seven, some of whom were jailed for more than a year for breaking into a U.S. nuclear submarine base in Georgia with the aim of symbolically beating swords into plowshares. Martha Hennessy explains why she did it.
Well, I was very influenced by the book Hiroshima by John Hershey, which Dorothy handed to me when I was a young teenager. And I also was very acutely aware of the essay that she wrote in September of 1945, excoriating the country, the government, the church, all of them, for supporting the dropping of the bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And those two things influenced me greatly in my life. And my very first arrest was related to nuclear power, Seabrook, New Hampshire, which I believe nuclear power is the other side of the coin of nuclear weapons. And so Kings Bay is located in South Georgia on the East Coast. It houses half of the what they used to call the Trident nuclear subfleet. It can strike anywhere on the planet within 15 minutes. And the fleet has enough firepower to destroy the world four times over. And I thought that was pretty crazy. So I knew other folks who had participated in a plowshares action. And we have to also bring in Philip and Daniel Berrigan into this story and this history. They started that movement the year that Dorothy died. And so I found myself with a group of six other Catholic workers. And we studied and planned for 2 years. And we went onto the base and we tried to bring the body of Christ to a place of great sin. We do call it a nonviolent direct sacramental act. And the plowshares bases its actions on Isaiah 2:4. We shall beat our swords into plowshares and our spears into pruning hooks. And so we symbolically hammered on these mock-up missile. It was an exhibit that the public would come to. And so we poured blood and hammered symbolically at that site. And then, of course, we were given charges of conspiracy, trespass, degradation of government property, destruction of naval property, something like that. And the whole purpose of these actions is to bring attention to this nuclear arsenal that is very much embedded in every district of Congress in the country. It's part of our economy. And yet we all pretend that these weapons don't exist and they're on hair trigger alert to be used anytime, anywhere.
Martha Hennessy. And just as she was inspired to what she calls nonviolent direct sacramental action by her late grandmother, Dorothy Day, so too in faraway Australia was Simon Moyle. He's a Baptist minister who led 14 protesters to their arrest after entering the SAS Army training facility on Swan Island in Victoria in 2013.
Dorothy and the Catholic Worker movement have been inspirations. The war in Afghanistan was part of a number of other actions that we were doing, both to bring attention to that, but also to, in some way, get in the way of that and slow that kind of machine down. A group of us went to Swan Island, which is an SAS training base in Victoria. Two of us blocked the gate and two of us got inside the base and switched off the power to a number of sectors in the base and to a satellite dish that was there. As I say, not just to bring attention to it and to recognise that this is a base that's doing harm in the world, but also to really get in the way of that and begin to slow that machine down and to take personal responsibility for doing that, not just to leave that to others or just to pressure politicians to do it, but to say that we as human beings, this is, as Christians in particular, this is our responsibility, so we'll step in.
But a Christian stepping in for peace in 2025 is very different than 1945. Back then, Australia, the United States, and the Catholic Church in both countries were focused on the war effort, doing all that was needed to defeat the Japanese enemy. So why did Dorothy Day remain a true and loyal Catholic, a church led, after all, by men with whom she fundamentally disagreed? I asked her biographer, Paul Eli.
It's true. Dorothy Day is maybe the vividest example of a Catholic character type that I see often. Politically progressive, even radical, and liturgically traditional. The Mass should kind of stay where it is. It belongs to everybody, the rich and the poor, the longshoreman and the social activist. It's not theater. It's not supposed to express ourselves. It's supposed to articulate the human longing for God in some kind of objective way. So in that sense, what we call the hierarchical aspect of the church, she would just recognize as a kind of fixity. Like, let's have the Mass be the Mass without being sullied by our personality, let's say. Plenty in the hierarchy opposed her, but they all knew she was holy, or most of them did. A lot of it had to do with war and peace. The Catholic Church, mid-century, was composed, as we've discussed, in large part of immigrants and the children of immigrants. When World War I broke out and then World War II, those children of immigrants were impelled to show their bona fides to the American way of life, to show their loyalty by uncritically signing on to American military action. I mean, these military actions had good objectives. Defeating Hitler, that's a pretty good objective. But as a pacifist, Dorothy Day felt bound to oppose those things no matter what the motives. So a holy woman, Catholic, Orthodox, traditional in worship, nevertheless called out the church hierarchs for supporting war out of a misplaced sense of patriotism. It was a huge divide, but the long-term effect was that she moved the entire church closer to a position of nonviolence than it had been in previous times. Pope Francis, in a joint session of Congress in 2015 in the United States, celebrated four great Americans who also embodied a kind of biblical authenticity: Abraham Lincoln, Martin Luther King, Thomas Merton, and Dorothy Day. When he went to Hiroshima, not too far from you all, a few years ago, he moved the church closer to a position of nonviolence, not only on nuclear weapons, but on weapons used as anything but a means of defense, substantially because of the stands that Dorothy Day had taken 50 years ago. So she influenced the whole church, and we're now closer to her than Cardinal Spellman or Pope Pius XII was.
In time, the church has come to agree with her on nuclear, but hindsight still has pacifism in World War II as problematic. You know, Hitler still looms as this archetypal figure of evil, and rightly so.
Absolutely. And to be a pacifist in World War II, that's a very troublesome position. She put it in early 1942 after Hiroshima: our country passes from undeclared war to declare war. We continue our pacifist stand. And the Catholic workers were vilified for that. And one can understand it. But at the same time, when the United States, using the brain power of the entire Western world, devised atomic bombs and dropped them on civilians in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the latter being the most Catholic city in Japan, their witness, the witness of the Catholic workers, became all the more important. How can you say that you're on the side of virtue when virtue and the practical argument for ending a war means incinerating hundreds of thousands of civilians in a moment? I'm not saying I have the answer to this, but I would not be, want to be without the witness of the pacifist, of which Dorothy Day was, a real leader in that moment. We can't understand that situation if we don't have the pacifist option as part of our religious imagination.
Paul Ely. And Dorothy Day's pacifism is very much a part of the Catholic Church's religious imagination. But during World War II, it was not. So what does it mean then that in 2012, US bishops unanimously voted to support opening Dorothy Day's cause for canonization? They used to call Dorothy Day a communist, now they want to call her Saint Dorothy. Her comrade, not in arms but in peace activism, is Robert Ellsberg.
People often quote a line that she supposedly said, where she said, don't call me a saint, I don't want to be dismissed that easily. And that would be a mistake to think that that meant she didn't revere saints and devoted to say, take that very seriously. But she wanted to be a saint, not necessarily a canonized saint. There's a difference. She said that we're all called to be saints, that being a saint is why we were baptized, to put off the old person, to put on Christ, to for our lives to be conformed to the gospel. She took that very, very seriously. So she revered the saints, and not just the canonized ones, but she all kinds of writers and philosophers and activists and martyrs and, peacemakers, etc., that would have been kind of in her kind of canon of saints. But she was very devoted to traditional saints like St. Francis, St. Benedict, Teresa of Avila, and Teresa of Lisieux, who was her favorite saint. So I think she would, respect that this is a process of the church, and it's not about honoring, someone posthumously. It's about recognizing the features of the gospel in the life of a person in a way that can inspire us in responding more faithfully to our own vocation. And I think that she would, she's not around. It doesn't concern her whether she's called a saint. But she did not want to be called a saint, by people who by that were putting her on a pedestal, saying, well, saints are perfect people. I could never do what those saints that the Catholic Worker do or what Mother Teresa does or whatever. She felt that was a way of letting people off the hook. So I think that the significance of her, potentially being canonized now, and I think it's inevitable, is that the church has come a long way to the point where she is very much at the center of the church and not some, marginal kind of figure that reflects all kinds of things from Vatican II and the Latin American church that promoted the preferential option for the poor. And certainly in this time of Pope Francis and Pope Leo, with the emphasis on mercy and on going out to the margins and the peripheries to touch the wounds of Christ among the poor, commitment to peace, ecology, care for the earth, refugees, immigrants, all these things, Dorothy is right at the center of that. So there are some people who fear that, if she's canonized, that'll make her somehow kind of an establishment figure and it will diminish her. My opinion is she's one of those kind of characters whose canonization enlarges the church and makes it more likely that people will know her story and learn about her message.
And that message is voluntary poverty, radical pacifism in communal Christian anarchism. And the Australian Baptist minister, Simon Moyle, inspired by Dorothy Day, has lived all three.
Anarchism's much misunderstood, I think, particularly the way that the word anarchy is used typically. It just really just means no bosses or, no one telling you what to do. And I guess for Christian anarchism, that's to say that it's really just Jesus that tells us what to do. And so it's not that there's no structures or that there's no power involved. In fact, my experience of anarchist communities is that there's much more literacy around power than there is in most other communities. So it's actually, for me, about recognizing that God is the one to whom we are answerable ultimately, and actually that in putting together those kinds of communities, we take account of every voice, that all voices matter. And I think that's what we see. I'm a Baptist, so we believe that the ultimate authority is God, and that that is discerned by the gathered community under the Holy Spirit. And so we actually have the authority, as it were, to discern what it is that God wills for us together, and that that is really the ultimate authority within our community.
Simon Moyle. And the Catholic worker-style community he describes, the anarchistic order he endorses, well, if he wants to live that way, good luck to him. But surely it's a neither viable nor desirable way of mainstream living in the 21st century. Isn't Dorothy Day's message at least partly extinguished by the noise from today's hyper-individual, post-secular world? Paul Eli.
It's a good question. I mean, the first thing to say in this connection is that Dorothy Day and the Catholic workers were a tiny minority in their time. Even now, 150 houses with 100 people at them, that's 15,000 people, you know, in a world of 8 billion, right? Her witness says that popularity is not the measure, that to be a Catholic worker, to live as an anarchist in community, to have self-sufficient farms, to practice voluntary poverty is valuable in itself, but it's also valuable as a reminder to everybody that there are other ways to live. And one of the problems that we're facing in our society now, it's the same problem she faced, but I do think it's a bit exaggerated, is that because of the power of the mass media and the fact that the mass media are owned by very rich people who have an unwavering belief in the quality of life as they define it, means that other ways of living aren't represented enough. And if you don't see the alternative, it's hard to act on the alternative, much less to devote your life to the alternative. Dorothy Day said, people love what is presented to them to love. And the gospel is not much presented, or God is not much presented. And that was true in 1955, and it's true in 2025. Thanks be to God, we have her writings and her story and the Catholic Worker Houses to remind us that there are other ways to live.
And the archive is online, every edition.
Absolutely. It was free or penny a copy. And it's just a matter of getting people's attention to go to it. In my case, the fact that the book you mentioned, The Life You Save May Be Your Own, is out in a new edition after 22 years means that Dorothy Day's story is still out there. And that as long as the story is told, we're here talking about it on the radio, something is happening.
Paul Eli from the Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace, and World Affairs. Earlier, we heard from Martha Hennessy, the granddaughter of Dorothy Day and lifelong member of the Catholic Worker Movement she founded. You'll find Martha at the Mary House on New York's Lower East Side, the building bought by Dorothy Day. Dorothy lived and died there, and it's still feeding and sheltering the hungry and sick on New York's Lower East Side. Thanks, too, to Robert Ellsberg, who edited Dorothy Day's Catholic Worker newspaper and worked closely with her in the final years of her life as the editor of her diaries and selected letters. They're entitled The Duty of Delight and All the Way to Heaven. Plus, Reverend Simon Moyle, the ordained Baptist minister, anti-war activist and non-violence trainer, an elder at the Grace Tree Christian Community in Melbourne, where they practice hospitality and contemplation in the Dorothy Day tradition. This has been the final in our special series on religious rebels, and special thanks to the series producers Rebecca Cushway and Amanda Roberts. All the episodes, including on Malcolm X and Joan of Arc and more, they're all on the ABC Radio National webpage or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for ABC God Forbid. I'm James Carlton. Until next week, please remember to be good. This has been God Forbid. We'll be right back.
been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.